So the big question up here is, what keeps me rational? Well, it's our user groups. And Wendy here, who's helping support all of our user groups around the world. 11,000 members. Glenn, what do you think?
I think it's great, and I think that what keeps me rational is that I know that all 11,000 members in our worldwide user groups, 94 different organizations, that they help support each other on a global and local level. If you're not part of your user group, join one today. And what do we say?
User groups rock!
Woo!
Yeah, cinemassa.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back your host, who's not your host, Mitch Fatel.
Hello. Salute.
Mitch Fatel.
It's me, your Duke. And I
made Mitch Fatel.
Oh, boy. Mitch, where are you, Mitch? I warned him about going to that jazz.net party. Guys are wild and crazy. Mitch! I know he was going to go to the iRise party to learn a little bit more about sketching last night. I can't see you guys out there. Can you look back and forth next to you on your left and right? Do you guys have Mitch out there? Anyone see Mitch? Who has Rebecca, you have his contract? He's supposed to be here. Well, look, we'll keep looking for him. I don't know.
Excuse me. Yeah. Excuse me, Scott?
Yeah.
We've located Mitch.
You found him? Where is he?
Hey, everybody. It's a beautiful morning here at SeaWorld. Where is everybody? We were supposed to meet at 6 o'clock.
6 p.m., Bonehead.
Oh, never mind.
I told him it was, Jesus, I told him it was 6:30 p.m., not 6:30 a.m., but that's Mitch. if you do Mitch Fatel on Google, if you do a search, you'll get 42,900 hits, so he has a long way to go. But if you actually do a search on Web 2.0, on Google, you get 185 million hits. That's 50 million more than you'll get if you do Paris Hilton, and she's certainly been in the news. And it's safe to say that we're not the only ones trying to find out more about Web 2.0, what the value of it is, how we can leverage it to a much better gain, not only in the business world, but in the personal world and how we all interact. And today, I'm pleased to, I'm fortunate for all of us to have John Patel here. Internet visionary and CEO, Business 2.0 columnist, a University of California, Berkeley visiting professor, an author, founder and CEO of the Industry Standard, and co-founding editor of Wired Magazine, and founder and CEO of Federated Media, and a thought leader on the tech-driven transformation that we're all seeing happening out there. With those credentials, it's no wonder we've asked him here today to give us his unique insider's view on what's really going on out there. Where are the internet innovations happening? What business models are working? What's next? And how it will affect our business and your business. Please join me in welcoming John Patel.
Hey, thank you very much. Thank you. Good morning. This is day 3 of Orlando. It's getting a little foggy in here. Thank you for getting up this early. I flew in last night at midnight. So for me, it's still 4 in the morning or 5 in the morning. So if I start dropping adjectives and verbs, you know why. I want to talk with you about Web 2.0. This is a world that I live in and have lived in since there was such a term, and I can take some either responsibility or blame for that term. But I want to first start by giving you a narrative history of my somewhat up and down career. So who is this guy? The first thing I'm going to say is, and it's not represented here, is that I covered enterprise software, wide area networks, local area networks, RDMS, all that good stuff, from 1987 to 1990. That's what I did. I was a trade reporter for many different technical trade publications. And I was fascinated by that world, which my mother did not understand my fascination with it. But I couldn't do it personally, but I could at least write about people like you who understood it and did it, and I thought it was going to change the world. And then I went back to UC Berkeley. I had gone there undergraduate, and I went back to Berkeley. And I went there to get a graduate degree in journalism because it struck me that everybody who I knew had no idea what I was writing about. I would send them these articles that I had written, and they'd say, "That's really nice, John, but half of the words in your article are acronyms. And I don't know what you're talking about." So I thought maybe if I went back to get a degree from Berkeley to sort of prove that I could write like a, you know, like a real journalist as opposed to a trade journalist, something good would happen. And I got an idea for a magazine, and that magazine was Wired. Now, the house lights aren't up too much, but how many of you guys are familiar with Wired? Thank you. All right. What a great magazine. It was kind of like starting a band. You know, we had five people, and we all brought in our Macintoshes. I'm really sorry, IBM. But that just so happened that everybody had a Mac, and we connected them together with the local talk cables, which were really the same as phone cables. So we like ripped the phone cables out of the walls and stuck them together. And we kind of started jamming, and we came up with this magazine. And we really had no idea what we were doing, which is sort of important. And that's, we're going to get back to that, because I think when you look at Web 2.0, there's a lot of that going on. We had no idea what we were doing, but we had a good idea. We wanted to make a new kind of magazine. And at the same time we were making it, 1992, 93, something else very important was happening, and that was the World Wide Web. And so at Wired, at the world headquarters of Wired, all 22 of us at this point were convinced that we needed to create a completely new portal for anybody who wanted to go to the World Wide Web and see what was out there. And in 1993 and 94, that wasn't a lot. So how many of you remember Hotwired? Thank you. All right. Well, so Hotwired was bigger than Yahoo for 1 week. In that week, I got a phone call from Yahoo asking me if I wanted to be the editor-in-chief of Yahoo. And I said, "Are you kidding? I'm the editor of the most important magazine in the world. Why would I ever want to join a company that has a dumb name like Yahoo? Maybe to retire at age 30. That would have been one good reason, but anyway. Now, I'm a guy who's been very involved in the magazine publishing and the online publishing business, and the publishing business is driven by advertisements. So Hotwired was the first place that there ever was a commercial banner, advertising banner. Here's how we came up with the idea for it. We were in an editorial meeting, which is, of course, where you should make all your business decisions. And in the editorial meeting, we said, "God, we have 50 or 60 writers who need to be paid. How are we going to do it?" And we thought, well, I said, "Hey, you know, I am a member of Prodigy. Many of you remember Prodigy? Yeah. And at the bottom of Prodigy, there's a blinking, flashing ad that never goes away. You can't scroll. It just sits there and kind of bugs you. How about we do something like that?" And the CEO, Lewis, who was also the editor-in-chief, said, no, John, let's put it up at the top so you can scroll it out of the way." That's how the ad banner was born. Clearly, it was a huge focus group there. And we're still in the middle of you know, that is still pretty much how advertising works online. I left in 1997 to start a magazine. I was noticing by then that a bunch of really interesting people were starting companies in the Silicon Valley, also in New York, in Seattle, in Austin, all around the world, really. But Silicon Valley was the nexus that were based on the web. And it struck me that most of the coverage of these companies were very one-sided. It was either the cover of Time magazine with someone going like, a little kid going, "Oh my God, it's kiddie porn, right? The internet, it's a terrifying thing. Don't go there." Or it was a lot of sort of bubbly talk about how this was all going to change the world. There wasn't a lot of rational financial journalism going on. And I thought if we could get something like The Economist mixed with something like Variety and do it on a weekly basis, you might have a good magazine. So I left Wired to start the Industry Standard. And the Standard did very, very well for a while. The Standard sold over 7,500 ad pages in 1 year, which is a world record in publishing. And if you're following how the media business is doing lately, it's probably going to stick, because the publishing business in print is certainly being undermined by the online world. Speaking of online, we started an online site called thestandard.com. Now, did any of you ever used to go to thestandard.com out there? There we go. See how it goes down from Wired to the Standard. So the Standard.com was meant for executives that were responsible for internet change in their businesses. And we had about 500,000 people come to this site in its heyday in the year 2000, 2001. 500,000 people came to the site every single month. I was very proud of that. Those are the kind of numbers you could go public on back then. We only spent $12 million to get those 500,000 people to the site, and that was almost an order of magnitude more efficient than most of the other web-based businesses in the late 1990s in terms of getting people to come to the site. $12 million, 500,000 people. Keep in mind that number because it'll be a test. Then, then everything exploded, both literally and figuratively in 2001. It was a bad year for the world. It was a very bad year for my industry. We lost 75% of our revenues, which were $220 million, in 3 months. We went from $220 million run rate to a $45 million run rate. That's hard to survive as a business. And so what do you do when you've started all these businesses and sort of become the poster child for publishing in the internet space, and you're out of a job, and you have no company? Go back to Berkeley. This time I had managed just at the right time to scoop up a professorship in journalism and particularly business journalism and web-based journalism. So I was teaching about how to create websites. I didn't believe the web was over. As a matter of fact, despite the fact that everybody was saying, that's over, thank God all that nuttiness is done, I still didn't believe that the core things that were changing about the economics of distribution, the economics of software delivery, the economics of media delivery, I didn't believe that that just was going to stop because the whole stock market decided to lose faith in a lot of difficult-to-understand IPOs. So I went searching for a story, because I'm a journalist, and I went back to sort of what I think I'm good at, which is telling those stories. I said, where is the story that's still around, even though this whole thing seems to have blown up and is now ashes at everyone's feet? And I found it in search. And so I started a little blog, a weblog. How many of you read weblogs? All right, excellent. I started a weblog in 2003 about search, and I wrote a book proposal, and Penguin was kind enough to accept my proposal, which for a New York publishing house in 2003 is somewhat insane. And I thought, well, here's the thing. I'm going to write a little weblog, and if a couple hundred people come and help me be less dumb about a topic which is very difficult to understand, the academic and technical underpinnings of search are actually quite complicated, why that would be good, because I'd like to actually, you know, be able to say things about search that make sense and make it make sense to a broader audience. So I figured a couple hundred people might show up on a monthly basis and help me look less dumb. In the first 6 months of my research, I averaged 60,000 visitors a month to this site. Clearly, there was an audience and an appetite about what was going on with search, and I had hit some kind of a nerve. I did end up writing that book, available at Amazon right now. And then while I was doing the research, I noticed a bunch of new companies were starting. Very similar to when I started the industry standard, I saw the same kind of, you know, ferment going on in the Silicon Valley. But this time, something was very different. This time, it wasn't about four MBAs getting together and getting, you know, driving across the country from Harvard and starting a business and getting $40 million of venture capital. It was about four geeks getting together in maybe one of their apartments or their mom's spare room or something and coding up something really gorgeous that they were doing because they had to, because they felt that, like, there was an opportunity to do it. They didn't have any venture funding, or maybe they had a couple hundred thousand dollars from some wealthy friends who had made money in the first bubble. But they were building these really interesting businesses really out of whole cloth. And I noticed with a partner of mine, Tim O'Reilly, who has a book publishing company, that there were so many of these companies and there was no place for them all to meet up. So that's how Web 2.0 came along. We said, we sat down and said, let's do a conference for this new industry, for this new movement. What should we call it? We said, well, we don't like the first version of the web. We definitely don't want to be associated with that. How about the second version? And so Web 2.0 was born, and I'm very sorry about it. that Web 2.0 has become a word that a lot of journalists sort of toss around as the next bubble, but really it has some intellectual underpinnings, and I want to go through those. Along the way, we made this really wonderful magazine called Make, if any of you have seen that, a sort of a Popular Mechanics meets Martha Stewart for the digital age. That's the Hollywood play. It's really fun. Check it out. And then here was where we get back to the test on the previous. Some folks from Boing Boing gave me a call. Now, Boing Boing is a weblog. It's one of the most popular weblogs in the world. It has something like 100,000 inbound links to the weblog from around the web. One of the most linked to websites in the world. These four editors make Boing Boing as a labor of love. They look around the web, they find things that are of interest, they go out and report them, and they write them up on this weblog. They do it a couple hours in the morning. They all have other jobs. It's not what their main job is, but it was a passion of theirs. And together they made this beautiful music, so to speak, this website called Boing Boing. And have any of you ever been to Boing Boing? There you go, that's pretty good. So they called me up in 2004 and they said, John, we have a real problem. I said, what's the problem? They said, well, our hosting bill is $500 a month. And they're all, you know, freelance journalists. This is starting to get to be real money for them because this is just a hobby. It's not a livelihood. And I said, what are you guys doing? My hosting bill at Searchblog was about $15 a month. And hosting, as you may recall, in 2004 was not exactly expensive. They were almost giving it away because there was such a glut of bandwidth. I said, are you posting video? And they said, no. And I said, well, how many people are coming to your site? And so we looked at their site logs, and we got rid of all the spiders and, you know, made sure that we were looking at actual IP addresses of real people. And we saw that 500,000 people were coming to Boing Boing every single month. 500,000 people for $500. Over here, 500,000 people, $12 million. Clearly, something was going on in terms of the business I was really in, which was media. Something very important in the economics of my business had happened, and it struck me something very important in the economics of everybody's business was happening, and that had to do with Web 2.0. I started a company called Federated Media, the one that I currently run, won't be spending much time on that today, to take advantage of that economic shift in the media business and represent sites like Boing Boing, sort of like a record label represents musicians, and that's my current business. So, let's talk about Web 2.0. Version 1.0 of the internet was very, very long on vision. There was an awful lot of vision being sold out there in the marketplace. It was short on execution. We didn't have what we needed to execute the big ideas. It was shorter on profits. The market and the technology was a little bit immature. Poor old sock puppet always gets to bear the burden of being the icon of the first version of the web. But I think we're into version 2. We're deep into version 2. Google is now the icon of the new web, long on execution, long on profits, and even longer, I believe, on vision. I think the things that can be built using the web now that we couldn't even have imagined in the first version of the web are truly astonishing, and that's one of the reasons why a person like me, who comes so deeply from the web world and the sort of consumer-facing, customer-facing world, can come to a conference where people are so involved in executing software for enterprises and say that we have a lot in common. I think that would have been very hard to do 10 years ago. So in one slide, Web 2.0, the rise of web as a platform where you can build businesses based on inexpensive communications and software and mass adoption. We did not have enough people using the web last time, a decade ago. Allows for highly iterative, lightweight, innovative companies leveraging the architecture participation, driving a new kind of commerce based on conversation. So did you get that? All right, I'm going to go through it. So the rise of Web 2.0. Now, I covered this, the first version of it, I covered at Wired and then at the Industry Standard. And like almost everybody else I worked with, I made some very classic mistakes. The biggest mistake that I made is thinking that the battle between Netscape and Microsoft, do you remember that? Mattered. Everybody thought that this was a battle to the death between Bill Gates and his nemesis upstart, Mark Andreessen, who's become a friend. And that's actually what Mark thought. And it's certainly what Bill thought, because we were all obsessed with thinking inside the box. And the box in this case was Windows, right? So anybody who controlled the window into the internet, known as the browser, they win, right? They win. But we were wrong. It doesn't matter the window in. Firefox is proving that right now. Because Microsoft won the window battle, they did kill Netscape, and they did take the majority market share with Internet Explorer, right? But it didn't matter the window. What mattered, what was in it, right? So Microsoft clearly did not get the market share it wished it had online because it didn't have stuff to put in the window that was near as good as the stuff that was being built outside of Microsoft. So that's a very interesting observation. Entrepreneurs began to build stuff for that window, inside that window, at an incredibly rapid pace in the last 5 to 6 years. And sites that made the crossing between Web 1.0 and Web 2.0 had one interesting thing in common. They were all platforms. So that's when Tim and I sat down and said, okay, if we're going to do this conference, we need to have a few, you know, really big themes. And the first one was the web is a platform. You guys are very familiar with the platform. Rational is a platform for development, right? Now, the web in the last 5 years has become a platform for development. It's a different kind of platform. But if you're going to drive businesses that at the very core are driven by IT, you have to have a solid ecosystem in which to develop, right? Windows was one of those kinds of ecosystems in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. I covered Windows and the rise of Windows. I covered Macintosh and the rise of the Mac. Linux became such a platform in the mid to late 90s, where you could do development in a way that you could actually depend on the results of it. And the web, I would argue, is such a platform now. People can develop businesses on the web using software that is stable and easily accessible. As a matter of fact, the cost of operation and the cost of acquisition of that software has gone down dramatically. And the sites that were winning had begun to embrace this idea of openness, right? We have open source, of course, but we also have open standards for data, open APIs and sharing of business practices and portability of data and so on. And these sites that have grown up on the web are absolutely heading in the direction of where most of the software development has been done in the history of the IT industry, which of course is in the enterprise. The best sites I've found are iterative. They launch and then they just rev and rev and rev and rev. They never have another version number. They just keep revving almost on a daily build basis. So what did I mean by the architecture participation? So this is a term that Tim came up with when we were sitting around scratching on a whiteboard trying to understand this Web 2.0 thing. What we noticed is with most of the businesses that had succeeded, what they had done is not only built a platform, then they had built a place that, on top of that platform where their customers could help them build their own business, right? So if you think about eBay, which has been an extraordinarily high-performing business over the last 10 years, eBay is a platform where people come along and pitch their tents and put up tables and put their wares on the tables and say, I'm selling you something, right? And eBay is basically enabling their business, their customers to come in and build eBay for them. Amazon is very similar, but they see that as their platform, the data that people create when you're on Amazon. So when you're on Amazon, every click, every purchase, everything you put in the cart, everything you take out, becomes a platform of data that they then pull back into their business and share back out to everybody else. People who bought this may also like that. That recommendation engine, using the data, the paths of your customers to create a merchandising opportunity, letting your customers build your own business. And there are so many examples of this in the Web 2 world. And the other thing is a remix culture of taking data from one place and data from another place and building a third business out of streams of data from two other places. And there are many examples of this. Another thing we noticed was that the truly interesting Web 2.0 companies were innovating in the way that they assembled data. It wasn't necessarily just owning a piece of the market or cornering a particular marketplace, but rather innovating in the way that data was being assembled and delivered to customers. A really good example is SpikeSource, which is in the enterprise space. But they basically took open source software and said, we're going to figure out a way to deliver it, package it, service it better than anybody else. There's tons of examples of this. In the hardware business, this is a very good example, and it's one that kind of resonates, which is Dell, right? Dell is a company that had nothing basically but commodity goods. As a matter of fact, I talked to Michael Dell and I asked him, you know, how many, you know, are you driven by patents? Are you driven by innovation in you know, circuit board design or processor design? He's like, no. We're driven by innovation in assembly, how we put things together, and how we get them to the customer quickly. So the next one was lightweight business models. And by lightweight, I mean, well, the example I gave you of Boing Boing earlier, $500 for 500,000 people, right? And then complaining about it, of course. but the idea that you can actually very quickly get to scale, you can very quickly find out if something's working, you can quickly iterate it if it's not, you don't need to raise $10 million and then fail, go out of business, go sit on a beach and worry about it for a year and think, God, what did I do wrong? And then go try again and convince someone else to give you $10 million, which was pretty much the model of the Valley back in the 90s. You can take $100,000, iterate, get something up, see if it works. If not, try something new. And so this ability to be quick, this ability to be nimble and to be highly iterative and to have a business model that's very lightweight is a very big implication for the Web 2.0 companies. Now, we'll get to this, but what's interesting is once it does start to work, you have to start to worry about process. You have to start to get rational. But getting to the point of understanding success, you can be very, very light and very, very nimble. And then, of course, many of you have probably read Chris Anderson's book, The Long Tail. Chris, the editor of Wired Now, so we're sort of kindred spirits, pointed out this idea, and it's a very important one from an economic standpoint. Before the web, there were so many uneconomic pieces of a particular marketplace. The music business is a very good example of that. If you were a band and you couldn't sell more than 100,000 albums, you were uneconomic to the record industry. They were not interested in signing you as a band because of the cost of manufacturing, distribution, marketing, production, all the things that go into making a band work. Just simply that you cannot economically support a band who can only sell 50,000 or 10,000 records. Now, when a band can access its bliss, in other words, its audience, even if it's 50,000 albums, right, if it can access those using the web, all of a sudden you have a very economic band for that band. Maybe not for the music industry, but for that band. If then you can build a company that can find tens of thousands of those kinds of band and aggregate them together and figure out a business model that works for both the band, for you, the company, and for the audience, why then you have MySpace, right? You have an incredible new form of distribution for music, for audience, and ultimately for the people using MySpace to connect to each other. And this is happening in any number of markets. And Chris's book is a great set of examples for that. He even has examples around beer. Now, I would say this, but I think one of the most important, the axis of Web 2.0 is search. Google and Yahoo being the two largest of the search players right now. Google consolidating to the point of almost starting to feel a little bit like Microsoft. Search, I argue in the book, is where our culture sort of makes its first inquiry of a computer. It's where our culture sort of turns the soil of the web. It's where we ask things. It's where we hope to get answers. It is our interface. And it's the axis of a business transformation that I call the transformation from a packaged goods culture to a conversational culture. And I want to talk a little bit about that. But when you think about conversations, they start with a question. They're the breath of life for conversation. And search, of course, starts with a question. Now, very smart companies see an opportunity online to provide a platform that allows them to have that kind of a conversation with their customer through services built around the core brand and the business promise. This is a very old kind of lesson. You know, what business are you in? Are you in the transportation business? Or are you in the train business? If you're in the train business, it's going to be hard to make this transition through search. If you're in the transportation business, you'll do it just fine. So the next book that I'm writing, you get a preview of it now because I haven't really talked about this much, but I'm so interested in this, is called The Conversation Economy, and it's about how businesses using Web 2.0 and understanding what it really means to them are going to make this shift through to the conversation economy. So here's a little bit of, I call it my three-bump background. IBM was very, very critical in the first bump of the IT industry. And this bump, what you're seeing on my left over here, is the number of dollars in the industry, IT industry in aggregate. And then over on this side, you're seeing the number of people who interact with technology. Okay, so in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, you had the first big bump of digitization of business, right? And that bump had to do with getting on the big iron, right? Getting the back office on big iron, getting the inventory and the payroll and the accounting systems all on. My dad was a controller for a mid-sized electronics firm that made, you know, car stereos and stuff. He was not a computer guy, but because he was a controller, he had to become a computer guy. So he would come home, I remember, in his briefcase, he'd pull out all these punch cards, right? And I'm like, Dad, what are those? You know, they don't make any sense. There's no words on them. They just have holes. And he's like, oh, that's Fortran, son. I'm like, Fortran? And he's like, sometimes it's COBOL. And I said, okay, sounds interesting. But it got me fascinated with this idea that we had a language that wasn't Chinese or Greek or Spanish. It was computer. And it was a language. And I found that very interesting. It was a conversational language. However, to speak it, you had to use an interface. And that interface was command line. Command line, which of course informed DOS. So command line interface was one where you got to the command line, and what did you speak? You spoke computer, right? You spoke COBOL or Fortran, or in the case of DOS, you started to speak a very interesting version of that language, which started with DIR, as I recall. Now, the next big bump was when everybody, all of us, this was the big moment for me anyways, because I didn't do a lot of big iron coding since I was 10, is when the front office got digitized. We all got computers on our desk. IBM revolutionized the world with the personal computer. And all of a sudden, we all got these machines on our desk that connected to the back office, where we could pull the data off the back office from the mainframe, from the big iron, and start to crunch numbers and make reports and even start to share those reports with each other through local area networks and wide area networks. This is when I started being a reporter. My beat was local area networks and wide area networks. I was fascinated by it. The idea that an information could be sent across the world was just fascinating to me. This had an interface. Now, I'm sorry, IBM, but I put a Macintosh up there because I'm an Apple guy. This is an Intel Apple, by the way. But this interface, which really is Windows, I'm just poking fun a little bit. This is a Windows interface, was a huge step forward. The number of people involved in the industry really raised a lot during the 80s with the personal computer, of course. And the size of the industry ballooned. This became an extremely important industry, and you had Bill Gates on the cover of Time magazine, right? You had IBM as the most important company of the era, and Microsoft as the upstart challenging IBM, you may recall. This was a big deal, but not nearly as big a deal as what we're in now. Now we're in this space where we're digitizing our customers. So we did the back end of our data, we did the front end of our data, we took all that data, and now we're figuring out how do we turn it inside out and face the customer with it. And, very important, how do we take what the customer is giving us back into our business? Okay? How do we take YouTube, where everyone's trying to give you something, and turn that into valuable business data for us? This is a huge shift. This blows away the other two in terms of number of people now interacting with technology. Pretty much everybody who's in the first world economy, and a lot more. And size of the industry. Eric Schmidt told me when I was reporting the book in 2005 that he thought the market cap potential for Google was just a little bit shy of the global GDP because they don't lack ambition over there. So this, I argue, has an interface, just as the first two bumps do. And I think it's Google. Now, for now. The interface to computing for the rest of the world is not Windows and it's not command line, it's search. So let's think about that for a second. How many remember this? Okay, I figured you guys would. So what do you do when you, what you guys might do at this line is a lot different than what I did, I'm sure. But what I did when I came to this line is I typed in DIR. And then, remember, you get a list of everything on your hard drive, right? And then what do? You bat.lotus123.exe or something like that, right? And then the program runs, and then you're off into a different interface, and you have to understand and learn that one, too. That's pretty much how the interface worked back at the first bump. Afterwards, we got a huge, as I said, shift in the interface. I call this the hunt and poke interface, right? You have that mouse, and you can hunt around, look, and then you double-click on something, and then it opens up a thing, and then what do you have? A list. But this time, you can just poke at it, and it opens, right? That's better than having to speak computer language when you're talking with a computer. It's sort of a sign language of computing, almost. So let's now look at search in the context of being an interface. What do you have? A command line. Just like DOS, you have a command line. It even has a blinking cursor in it, right? And then what happens? This is the magic. Instead of putting in computer language, you put in natural language. You put in words. You put in things that we understand as human beings naturally. Now, we don't all put in the same. Everybody's got their own particular Google grammar, right? Everyone sort of has their way of talking to the machine. But the fact is, we're talking with the machine. But what do you get? Well, for the most part now, a list of results just like you did when you put in dir. That's where we are with the search interface, just at the very beginning. But where we might be going is really, really exciting. I use the example of a car. People don't realize how complicated it is to drive a car. We take it all for granted. We are sitting down, we've got this steering wheel in front of us, we have like 16 dials and lights and gauges and buttons, and we've got a stick shift down here, and we've got two or three pedals, we've got three mirrors so we can look bi-directionally, which is pretty amazing, at the same time. And we've got all sorts of stuff happening in front of us that we either ignore or react to depending on whether or not we want to run into something, right? All of this we do in real time, sometimes at speeds exceeding 70 miles an hour, right? And most of the time we don't crash. How do we do that? Well, we as human beings are very good at taking in lots and lots of signals and navigating through lots and lots of data. Okay, and if you can imagine the search computing interface as being that kind of a signal and data-rich environment, I think that's where the interface is going with computing. Conversation is probably the highest evolutionary form that we've ever taken. I would argue that conversation, the ability, doing what we're doing right now, is extremely evolved and extremely difficult. And I think as one of the most nuanced things that we do as human beings, conversation will be the interface of computing in the future. So I want to give you one example of where search might go. How many of you have ever been to Whole Foods? All right, now Whole Foods, you don't go in there for a bargain. It's a good stock, though, I'll tell you that. The stock's doing great. I started watching the stock when I first thought about this example for my book. So imagine it's next year, because it's really all the technology to do what I'm about to describe to you exists. So it's next year, and you're buying a dinner for a big, you're going to do a dinner for your boss. She's going to come over, you want to impress her, and so you're getting your tri-tip grass-fed organic beef, and you're getting your broccoli rabe, and you're getting your maybe some pasta, some nice, $10 a box pasta. And then you say, I've got to get just the right wine for this meal. So you go to the wine aisle at Whole Foods, right? And the wine aisle at Whole Foods is a testament to hierarchy, right? You're standing there in front of it, $120 bottles, $80 bottles, $60 bottles, $40 bottles. You never bend down at Whole Foods. Because if you do, everyone around knows you're cheap. You don't want to do that, right? And anyways, this is for your boss. So you're going to be, well, maybe here, right? So you pull down a bottle of something you think, Stag's Leap 2001 Napa Valley Merlot, okay? You're looking at that and you're like, oh man, I can just feel getting ripped off. I can just feel it, right? But you've got your mobile phone. Take your mobile phone, take a picture of the label, turn the mobile phone over, and there's a search result that says 2001 Stag's Leap, Napa Valley, Merlot, average price in your neighborhood, $60. You turn it over, $85. You're getting ripped off. But there's more on your screen. It says, click here to reserve a bottle at Joe's Liquors 3 blocks down the street. Click here to have it delivered to your house. Click here for reviews from your friends. Click here for reviews from Robert Johnson and other noted wine experts. Click here for information about whether or not it's organic or any child labor laws were violated. Or you can imagine, right? That is an organic search created by simply clicking a button in the context of where you are. The phone knows where you are. The bottle has a label that tells the phone and the system where you are, and all of a sudden, search has become a gestural interface, right? And that's where search is going. Any question, anything that comes up at any place, at any time, connected to anything that has to do with something of value to your life, Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, IBM, and many others are working very diligently to figure out how to extract value from that exchange. It's a very, very interesting concept, and it's certainly going to change the idea of how commerce is delivered to you. So, search as interface is actually happening. When I wrote the book, I was like, I don't know if I'm right or not, but it seems like it probably is true that this idea of search becoming a more robust navigational interface is going to happen. And sure enough, the last year we have seen Ask, Google, Microsoft, and Yahoo all move their search interfaces from the command line to a much more robust conversational interface. Ask being the latest, so they just changed their entire, I would suggest you check it out, their entire search result page to be multi-pane and multi-interface, and it's based on eye-tracking studies of people's ability to take a lot of information in, and instead of hitting, you know, three words return, giving it a much richer interface that you can interact with. And that's just the beginning. So if conversation is the model here for the interface, what does that mean for business and for media? Well, first of all, if you look at ComScore, which is a reporting company that looks at where companies are growing, where they're not, slowest growth are in old internet properties. The new, fastest growing properties are all what I call conversational media. Wikipedia, Fox, which is MySpace, YouTube, all growing at triple or quadruple digits. And then if you look at the rest of the internet, it's growing or it's actually shrinking. Why are these sites growing so quickly? Well, because they're conversational. They let the users be part of building the site. More than 50 million Americans are reading blogs where people can contribute to the conversation. MySpace is the biggest US web destination. And YouTube, the largest YouTube video, has almost 40 million viewers. So what I've noticed is that users want a business that they're interacting with online to understand them, to get them. I mean, really, in almost a teenage way, don't you get me? Right? To organize themselves around what they're declaring as their intent, right? In real time. They want a business to intelligently converse with them the way search does. So if you think about search, it's really astonishing that you could go to a place, say a few words, and the whole world reorganizes itself around you. You go to Google and say Chevy minivan, and all of a sudden you have World O Chevy minivan built for you in 0.2 seconds. That has created a universe of users who expect you to do that for them even when they're not on Google. That's the interface. You just say something, the whole world changes around what you say, right? Shouldn't the whole world be like that? We've created, or I should say, Google and Yahoo have created this expectation of our customers, our users, that the world's going to change around their declared intent. And that means we have to figure out how to do that without breaking the back end, right? So users are attracted to these conversational sites. And when they get to those sites, there is a shared set of community. When you're having a conversation, there are rules. There's context. There's dinner table conversation, right? There's body or conversation, there's business conversation, so all sorts of kinds of conversations. And they expect that businesses joining those conversations understand the rules inherently. They know the frame that they're in, the context that they're in. And so how can businesses figure out that frame and get into that conversation in a way that helps them do business? Well, I think those that will, that have figured that out and that are going to figure it out in the next 5 to 10 years are going to win. So the question becomes, I believe, and this gets sort of the point of what you do for a living, is how do you make software that understands that? I think we're really at a very, very interesting point. And I was talking with all the folks at Rational earlier about this, and it was really, for me, a sort of an aha moment. We are driving 2 points towards the middle right now. You've got a web model of software. Now, I have a software-driven company that I run, Federated Media. We built an application that was customer-facing, that had a back end, and it took us about 6 months to build it, and then we just threw it up there. And we are now on, I don't know, the 700th iteration of it. I don't even know the version that we're on right now. It was absolutely not ready, what you might call enterprise ready. But we had to get it up and see and iterate and iterate and iterate. It was fast. It was iterative. Keep it simple. It was loose. And it was entirely focused on how do I get that conversational interface right. Most Web 2.0 companies are like this. Let's just get it right where the user hits us. We want to get that right. We'll worry about the back end later, right? Now, the enterprise model, which I did cover for 4 years and I've kept at least somewhat involved with and pay attention to, particularly when there's interesting companies that are coming out of that world that cross over into the Web 2.0 world, like Salesforce, for example, slower, custom, stable, focus on getting it right. You cannot build a software system for a Boeing jet and kind of hope it works out, right? Thank God, as I flew one of those on the way over here. But this sort of fast and loose interface on the one end and this get it right on the back end on the other end are really driving towards the middle and can learn one from the other. There's no question about it. A good example is YouTube. I was following this company for a very brief life. Never has a Mayfly been worth $1.6 billion. 9-month-old company, $1.6 billion. But here was a company that really two guys sitting around going, gosh, I really wish I could upload videos and share them with my friends. I mean, literally, that's how it started. And they said, oh, well, here, whip out some code, use some open source stuff, throw it up, see what happens. And then it was a race to either get acquired or to blow up, right? Because they did not have a scalable software back end that was going to allow them to get where YouTube is now. There was no way. As a matter of fact, one insider told me that YouTube was almost exactly 45 days from literally melting down when Google bought them, because they could not handle the demands on the database back end. They did not have a software platform or an approach to development that would allow them to scale. And so it was very lucky that Google came along. I think Google's very aware of that, of course. But they saw that user interface. Someone had figured out how to have a conversation around video in a grammar that worked for the world. Extremely valuable, right? Then Google came in, which has an extremely rigorous software development platform, and said, we'll help you out. So I want to give you a couple of fun examples to close from my business, not that they relate directly to yours, but they kind of explain. If you think about marketing and media and businesses, we have been approaching how to talk to our customers pretty much the same way for 100 years. In a packaged goods mentality, we make 30-second spots, right? Or we make print ads that are beautiful, or we make radio ads, right? We make these things that sort of say, okay, all you guys, stop what you're doing. Listen to me, sorry for the interruption, but I want to tell you about my product. And if it's in the middle of a sports thing, there's probably pretty girls involved. If it's in the middle of a television program in the middle of the day like Oprah, there's probably ads for minivans involved that are driving on winding roads. But we know how marketing works in the pre-search access world, the pre-conversational world, but how might it work in the world of conversation economy? So marketing that seeks permission and invites people into a conversation is starting to work, and I want to give you a couple examples of that. Cisco. Now, Cisco is a really interesting company. They're doing a lot of interesting things. Right now, they've got a campaign going about the human network. How many of you have seen this? It's got the Tibetan school kids and the, you know, I mean, it's gorgeously shot and all these, you know. And what they're trying to say is, I know, guys, that we make really boring boxes you never see, right? But that connects the human network together. And they're trying to create a brand around the human network. And they said, well, they came to us and they said, well, how do we make a brand that means something? If people want to know what the human network is, and they go to Google, they put human network in, they get a mishmash of results that means nothing. We want it to mean something. So what we did is we got 10 leaders in the technology business together to have a conversation about what it meant. We put that conversation online, and we got people to come to the conversation and add their own. Put up a wiki page where they defined what the human network was. And within 2 weeks, the human network, number two definition, was that page. And within a month, Wikipedia had picked up on it and written, and the Wikipedia editors, who you certainly can't control or buy, they're impossible to do either, had built a page, a Wikipedia page, about the human network, a marketing campaign popularized by Cisco in 2006. So Cisco started a conversation online about the human network, filled up that vessel that is a brand, right? Filled it up with meaning online so that when people go and put human network into Google or Microsoft or any other search engine, people see that there's a conversation going on around this brand, and then they feel like they understand the brand better. That's a very interesting example of how to do marketing in this new world. You guys may like this. How many of you are IT administrators, just so I know how many I'm about to potentially offend in the room? Look at that, not too many of you, okay. Generally speaking, people who are IT administrators or in the IT department, particularly of larger companies, aren't a happy lot. Is that a fair thing to say? Actually, I think they're all secretly very joyful, but they put up this front of not being happy. There is a jobs board called DICE. It's about to go public, actually, DICE. And it recognized that its core audience, number one, of course, is online. Number two, may not be as happy in their job as perhaps they could be. So, using the parlance and the grammar of this group of people, they asked their customers, does your tech job, last word, I'll let you, not so good? Is it not so good? And what they did is they took the actual banner, this is really cool, and they turned it into an IM chat where you can go into the banner and type, you know, my boss is really lame, or everyone I work with just doesn't understand. I go to this one person, and he keeps asking the same stupid question every week. Can't he figure it out on his own? You know, and the amount of stuff that came in was amazing. And so what they did is they took the media that they put on the sites, and they turned it into a conversational network between all these disparate IT guys around the world using the banners as a way to communicate with each other. And at the top part, everything they said scrolled through, and of course you could go to a site and find even more. Now, the neat thing they did was a little piece of JavaScript that let everyone put in whatever they want into there and see it instantaneously right in front of them and think it was going around the world in the network, but in fact, of course, it had to go through a human being to make sure that there wasn't things being put up there that weren't safe for work. And you should have seen the stuff that was put up there. It was quite something. Now, but the thing is almost 8 minutes of interaction in this banner, almost 8 minutes per user. The average IT news site, and you all know this because I'm sure you all go to IT news sites, the average time a person spends on an IT news site is about 35 seconds, right? They come in, they read the article, they leave. So for a marketing company, not a marketing company, a IT jobs board company, to get 8 minutes of their time, that's conversational marketing. Symantec did something very interesting. They started a blog, the blog got popular, and then they did an RSS feed of their blog into the actual ad unit. So now people see Symantec ads, and there's content from Symantec talking about the latest virus or the latest patch or whatever in the ad unit. So the ad unit literally becomes a way of having a conversation with your customers. Again, a very interesting conversational economy evolution. And then this is the last one, and I thought it'd be kind of funny. How many of you are familiar with Ask a Ninja? Yeah, all right. Well, those of you who know it, probably love it. Ask a Ninja is, well, there's two of them, they won the YouTube Best Video Artist of the Year recently. They are a phenomenon on YouTube, and we work with them. And we tried to figure out how do you do marketing in the context of Ask a Ninja. It's very safe for work. They never swear, you know, but they are the funniest guys in the world, and they have a very particular way of creating videos. They're these three-minute videos. And we thought, how do you do that so that the marketers, the business gets involved and isn't just running 30-second spots? Well, what we figured out to do is to get the character to actually be involved in the campaign. So in this case, the ninja got involved in, the sponsor was ask.com, kind of a perfect combination, and they got involved in driving their viewers, the Ask a Ninja viewers, to ask to look for a special Easter egg that they put in the index only if you were an Ask a Ninja viewer. And I'll just show you the little commercial that they shot as part of this.
This episode is brought to you by ask.com. Go to ask.com. Type in this ninja word twice as fast as you physically can, and you'll either get a cool ninja video treat or a sword in your head. That's a pretty good deal. I'd take that risk, but I'm a ninja.
If you want more of that, or if you have kids that are sort of 9 to 14 and you want to be cool, go to askaninja.com. My son can't believe I know the ninja. He just cannot believe it. It's so exciting for him. he's like, the ninja answered my email. And I'm like, cool, all right. So just to close, search is a new interface to computing, but it's more than that. It's the beginning of a new customer-driven, user-driven culture. And that heralds the rise of this conversational media, which means businesses have to adapt from taking traditional approaches to interacting with markets, including internal markets, not just consumer markets. Creating a platform for users to interact with your brand and your services is critical, and learning to join that conversation on the terms of your users is going to be how we succeed. So thank you very much for your time, and I hope we can take some questions.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
That was absolutely fascinating.
Great, thank
fascinating.
You. Thank you.
Just a couple questions.
Yeah.
Actually, probably a lot of questions because I got a bunch of them queued up here. What about enterprise search? You know, real enterprise, corporate search. How do you think that's going to affect?
In the book, it's funny. In the book, I tell one very long story about enterprise search, and then I put a footnote in saying, that's all. I can't write any more about enterprise search because I'm not sure I have the talent to make it interesting. But the one story I told was about IBM.
Right.
And IBM has a really fascinating a product called WebFountain, which has yet to find its bliss as a commercial application, but is extremely powerful. But what happened right after the book came out, and I write in the chapter of the paperback, which has been updated, I miss the enterprise search story. I believe that enterprise search is actually how we're going to get to what I showed as the new interface for search. Why? Because corporations have something that messy Web 2.0 companies don't, which is they have structured data, an understanding of customer behavior, and the ability to take all of that, figure out the patterns, and surface those patterns back to the user, right? And so we're starting to see some of the most interesting applications on the web come out of enterprise search or approaches to enterprise search. So I think it's going to be really, really important.
So that's the fusion that you were alluding to.
Exactly.
It's interesting. Now, what about one of the things here all week we've been talking about Second Life? Actually, we're broadcasting all this in our Code Station Island. We did some stuff with Dr. Dobbs.
Cool.
We had a reception out there. And so we're building the community that used to get together physically here every year, you know, around a virtual Second Life, right, where we can get together all the time, do education and training. How do you see the Web 2.0 technology affecting that?
I think, you know, Second Life is a harbinger of where we're going to be in a period of time, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. You know, there's always going to be the first adopters, and then there's the rest of us who follow at some point afterwards. In the late 1980s, kind of 86, 87, when I was at Berkeley, after I graduated, I joined a community called The Well. And The Well was an online community where we argued about everything. It was basically a bunch of people who liked to argue. But the thing that really drew everyone together was a love of the Grateful Dead.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had a bunch of deadheads who happened to be also technologists who created a community that pretty much mirrored almost every internet site now that has email and chat rooms. But this was 15 years before. I think that you see the same thing with Second Life. I think it's extremely important. They are building a grammar online that is going to inform, I think, all of our interactions online over the next 10 to 20 years.
Right, right. Interesting. A couple more questions. You know Judson Lipley, The Evolution of Dance on YouTube?
Yeah, yeah.
He was here, was it yesterday? The day before. He was here Monday.
Cool. I missed him.
Yeah, it was great. It was one of the best things we had going here. And he talked about 50 million viewers has seen him up there. So you had mentioned 40 million.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's amazing, you know, to talk to him back, you know, backstage and all that. Can you imagine? He was just out there. He does corporate communications.
Yeah.
He made that video.
Right.
50 million viewers. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And he gets gigs like this. And it's quite amazing what that has done.
Yeah. Well, the YouTube culture is teaching us one thing, which the speed with which we can find that which we are interested in, both individually, that little answer that just means so much to you because you're trying to find whatever you need to find to get your job done.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't scale to 50 million, but there are 50 million people having that aha moment, right? And then finding the speed to which we get to the point that we all collectively find something that we're fascinated with.
Right.
Both of those are being shrunk by search. And so now we have assumptions when we sit in front of our computer or our mobile device that that's just the way it is.
Right.
That speeds up the productivity to the point where our culture goes through a significant shift. And,
right.
and that, I think that's really, really exciting.
I got to just tell you one last story, then I'll let you go. This is the 10th anniversary of this conference.
Congratulations.
Yes, thank you. We had a record attendance here.
That's great. Yeah.
And so one of the things we thought we would do is celebrate the community, right?
Right.
And give them a voice, and because, you know, many of these people have been back, some of them going back 10 years, right?
Right?
And so we did this thing called rationaltube.com.
Right,
if you,
right,
get, if you get bored, yeah, go out there and take a look at it. This was a takeoff on YouTube, right?
Right.
And now everyone to express their, you know, what keeps them rational.
Right.
Right. Is it personal stuff? Is it the technology? Is it the community? And it's amazing how many people are getting up there. There's all kinds of interesting videos.
Right.
You're seeing them. You saw the intro one, right?
Cool.
And it's just fascinating how it really does drive that kind of conversation.
Yeah. Well, I commend Rational and IBM for getting over the fear of allowing your customers to tell you what they want. That is a big, big shift.
I have to laugh at that. See these two right here? Our corporate standards are being violated by using that, and they're going to want us to take it down when we get back from here. We're saying, well, no, because we're not going
to
do that.
Tell them to give me a call.
That's right. I'll tell them, call Danny Saba. We'll, you know, we'll deal with that. But we're going to roll this out internationally.
Okay.
We're going to Beijing, and you know, we're going
great.
To Bangalore. We're going to do the YouTube in native language. It's going to be a lot of fun. So,
cool. All right.
But anyhow, I know. Thank you very, very much for being here.
Right.
It was fascinating.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
John Patel. That was truly fascinating. Okay, so a little bit of housekeeping before we break for the day and send you off. First of all, there's pre-signed copies of John's book, The Search, that's available in this bookstore that's out on the floor. I encourage you to make sure that you get out there and read the book. It really is interesting. It will elaborate on much of what John just talked about. In addition to that, the conference evaluations, please make sure you go out to the kiosk. Do that, you can pick up a t-shirt at registration. We really want to get your feedback. We want to really understand what we can do next year and the other events that go on for the rest of the year to really improve this conference for you. And the evaluations are really critical. I can tell you, we analyze those to death. We really read every single comment. All of us across the executive team are actively involved in making sure that we understand what you're saying. So it's really important that you do that. In addition to that, the conference proceedings will be made available. There's a post-conference CD that you all get. The audio breakout sessions on the CDs also. So I just want to make sure you're aware that you're going to be getting all that. And don't forget, there's should be a chart behind me, which there it is. Actually, it's not in front of me. It's behind me. Breakout sessions. Make sure you go to those breakout sessions. As Mitch would say if he was here, it's the tracks. Man, it's all about the tracks. Make sure you're going to those. We also, as you can see here, are doing a repeat session of the jazz sessions. We had two of them yesterday. They were blowouts. The first one, we couldn't even fit enough people. I think we ended up turning away a lot of people. We're going to do a repeat of that, as you can see in the times here. Very, very interesting conversations I've heard in the hallways about these jazz sessions. I really encourage you, if you haven't been to one, to go again. If you've been to one, go again, because I think you can learn even more. It's really strategic to where we're going, and you know, it's going to shape our portfolio for years to come, very much like Eclipse did starting 5 years ago. So again, take advantage of that. You know, Clear Labs, a lot of good interaction going out there. You know, as I mentioned before, just a couple minutes ago with John, let's do get your RTube videos out there. get them uploaded. You see all the web cameras out there. We'll be doing the awards tomorrow. I'll talk about that in a second. But we're going to be giving away things like, iPod videos and things of that nature. And, of course, today's the last day for the exhibit hall. Make sure you get out there and see all the demos and, from our business partners and so forth. Now, then finally, your game card. Make sure you're out there filling that out. All right, tomorrow, our final session, day four. You know, we're going to end by having Jim Corrigal, who's our general manager of ISV and developer relations. He'll be here to, talk about what we're trying to do to keep you rational from a support perspective. What can we provide you on things like DeveloperWorks, right, to continue to provide the education, the training, all the things you need to be successful and really to learn from you as we go forward. We'll be doing the giveaways, as I mentioned before, the video package, the video iPods, VIP conference passes for next year. You need to be there to win, though. So please make sure you're here tomorrow. And then finally, the fun starts tomorrow night. Or actually, tonight. Tonight. That's right. I almost blew it. Mitch Fattel actually blew it because he's there now, as you know, rather than here, because he thought it was 6:30 a.m. and not 6:30 p.m. But anyhow, thank you very much to Intel for sponsoring that event tonight. Make sure you're there. We're going to try to find Mitch. And for anyone that finds Mitch, you get 10 years worth of conference passes at no cost. So go tonight and try to find Mitch. You'll never believe where he is. If you find me there, come ask me and I'll tell you where he is, all right? Because I know where Mitch Fattel is today. And if you find him, again, you can get those passes. So with that, let's check in with Mitch. Let's see what's going on at SeaWorld since he obviously is not here. Mitch, you out there?
Even though you guys aren't here, I gotta be honest, this is way more interesting than Scott Hebner. I still get paid, right? I'm here now with the penguins. This is great. They're all so lifelike. Look, there's Grady. He looks bored. He must be watching last year's conference when I wasn't hosting.
Let me down! Let me down!
Ooh, the Shark Tank. Look, that's an IBM executive. And those are software companies. Thank you for having me at the conference. I wish you could have been here with me today, but you guys will have a great time here tonight. Thanks for having me, and I'll see you guys next year. Thanks, Scott and Daniel and everybody. Here we go. Oh my God, this is very exciting. See you next year.
All right. He wants to come back next year. We want him back or what? Yeah, all right. When I get back home, I'm going to go see one of his real acts. We'll see what's really up with that. But in any event, thank you very, very much for being here. Thank you, John, for being here. Have a great day, and we'll see you tonight at SeaWorld.
Take care, everybody.